Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, we're going to be having a chat about one of history's most famous duels. Now, of course, throughout history, there's been stuff like the Horatii and the Curatii, the Petticoat Duel, and, of course, the Sandbar Fight, which you'll remember from episode 72. But perhaps the most famous duel to emerge from history, particularly these days, obviously with a renewed interest in it, thanks to a certain musical, is the one that took place between political rivals Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. In the early morning of the 11th of July in 1804, these two bitter political rivals, they rowed out to the shores of the Hudson in New Jersey and attempted to settle their differences with pistols. Now, I mean, I don't want to spoil the ending here, but you probably know how it turned out. Very famous story we're talking about here, so you know, probably know how it all ended. If you don't, however, you can't really complain about it being spoiled. Like, it's been over 200 years. You know, that's probably long enough to have found out about it. Anyway, the duel took on a larger-than-life aspect in history and had a reasonably important effect on the very young United States of America, which was still finding its feet politically. You probably know that Hamilton had been the Secretary of the Treasury, pretty important bloke overall, founded the Federalist Party, founded the Coast Guard, very important in the development of the U.S. banking system as he founded the first central banks in the United States. But did you know that Aaron Burr, even at the time of the duel itself, was the Vice President of the United States? Imagine that these days. Imagine the Vice President of the United States picking up a gun and shooting another public servant. I mean, it just wouldn't happen, would it? It wouldn't happen. I mean, the last time this took place, the last time something as ridiculous as this took place, you know, the Vice President shooting someone, geez, how long ago was it? Whew, like, what, 2006? I mean, oh, it's been so long. It's not even 15 years ago since the last the last time that a vice president of the United States shot someone. Anyway, today we're going to have a chat about not only the duel itself, obviously, but the lead up to it. Why these blokes hated each other and how it actually got to the point where they arranged to go and have this duel and shoot at each other. There's a lot to get across here today. So let's get underway. Meet our cast of characters before finding out how their lives actually, you know, ended up intersecting in this huge way here. So we're going all the way back here to, well, honestly, actually, I'm not 100% sure. I thought I'd start the respective biographies of these two blokes, with whichever bloke was older. But we actually don't know. Unbelievably, we don't know which of these two blokes was the older one. Aaron Burr, we know that he was born on the 6th of February in 1756, while Alexander Hamilton was born on the 11th of January in either 1755 or 1757. We actually don't know 100% which one it was. I suppose we'll just start with Hamilton, you know, because I guess there is a chance he's the old one after all. So yes, Alexander Hamilton, born in Charleston on the island of Nevis, which is today's part of St. Kitts and Nevis, a small island nation in the Caribbean. And as I say, he was born in either 1755 or 1757. He himself claimed it was 1757, but he was generally pretty vague about his age later on in life, and he sort of only spoke about it in kind of round figures. And these days, there's a bit of evidence to suggest that it may have actually been 1755 after all. Look, we don't know. Whatever the case, he grew up in the West Indies and had a pretty hard go of it with his childhood. His childhood was full of hardship. His father abandoned his mother when he was just young, and then his mother died when he was only 13, leaving him and his brother penniless. But young Hamilton, he found his feet. He worked with a trading company and then ended up in Boston in 1772. And it was in the 13 colonies at the time that he joined a revolutionary militia in 1775 after the battles of Lexington and Concord. And he became a captain of a company that fought in New York. And ultimately, he was invited to become an aide to George Washington himself, during which time he rubbed shoulders with many famous people from that era and made, very important political connections. But he longed for the battlefield, he did. And after having left Washington's staff, he was eventually given command of a battalion that fought in the Battle of Yorktown, which is where the American Revolutionary War effectively came to an end with the British surrender. And after the war was over, He got married. He worked as a lawyer before moving into politics, where he represented New York at various political conventions. He was a signatory of the U.S. Constitution. He contributed to the very famous Federalist Papers, which you may have heard of, and ultimately ended up being appointed as the first Secretary of the Treasury by Washington. So the United States, the first ever Secretary of the Treasury was, of course, Alexander Hamilton. He's on the $10 note, and there's a good reason for that. And it's here as the Secretary of the Treasury that he clashed with people like Thomas Jefferson, a clash that gave rise, I might add, to the rivalry between the Federalist Party and the Democratic Republicans. As we talked about in episode 103, the Federalists, led by such people as Hamilton and John Adams, they were happy to interpret the Constitution pretty liberally, while Jefferson's Democratic Republicans were much stricter, and they believed that if the Constitution didn't expressly allow something, it was therefore prohibited. They were very, very constructivist in their approach to constitutional interpretation there. So Hamilton and Jefferson, they sparred on all sorts of political matters, with Hamilton as a Federalist and Jefferson as a Democratic Republican. And this helped set the stage for ongoing political conflict after Washington's presidency, once Federalist John Adams succeeded the independent Washington. But ultimately, Hamilton resigned from his position in Washington's administration in 1795, after his wife had a miscarriage, very unfortunate indeed. And so he returned to New York, worked as a lawyer, in order to be close to his family, spend more time with his family there. And the very next year, in 1796, Adams won the presidential election. And you might have thought, fantastic, Hamilton would be very happy with this. They're both Federalists after all. But despite them both belonging to the same party, Hamilton didn't like Adams at all. And as a result, was a lot less active in federal politics. Instead, as we'll discuss in a sec, this period between the 1796 and 1800 presidential elections, when Hamilton was back in New York, when he was working there, this was when the rivalry between he and Burr really took off, while Hamilton had kind of pulled back from federal politics a little bit there like that. But it wasn't to last, however, because as the 1800 presidential election loomed on the horizon, Hamilton actually began to campaign. He began to chuck some of his political weight around, campaigning against John Adams. And as unbelievable as it sounds, this bloke was going around actually campaigning against the incumbent sitting president, right, who was, of course, the Federalists' own primary candidate for the presidency. And you've got another high-profile bloke from the same party going around saying, no, don't elect him, right? So he was, obviously he was also opposing the Democratic Republicans as well. He was pushing his own agenda there. But all he managed to do, right, in attempting to campaign against Adams, all Hamilton managed to achieve was a huge split in the Federalist Party. And this just guaranteed the victory of his political rivals. And so this ushered in a Democratic-Republican administration, which of course, involved Thomas Jefferson as the president and none other than Aaron Burr as vice president. But who was Aaron Burr? We move now to have a look at the other half of our dramatis personae here. Born in Newark in New Jersey on the 6th of February in 1756, he was either a year older or a year younger than Hamilton, as we said. And he too had a bit of a rough time as a kid. He was orphaned at the age of two. His grandparents followed his parents to the grave the next year. And so he and his sister ended up with their uncle. And this wasn't a happy arrangement, unfortunately. Burr tried to run away from home on more than one occasion. And he ended up actually getting away to go to school at the age of 13. And after studying until he was 19, he abandoned his legal studies in 1775, again after Lexington and Concord, and joined the Continental Army to fight in the American Revolutionary War. So you can see some broad parallels between these two blokes in their early lives. Now, he fought in a fair few battles. He served under the famous turncoat Benedict Arnold for a while. And he too also ended up on Washington's staff as well. But he quit before too long to go back to the battlefield and developed a dislike of Washington, it has to be said, after the general failed to commend his heroic fighting in New York. In 1777, he was given command of a regiment, but in 1779 had to resign his position as his health was failing him. So he went back and finished his studies as a lawyer, got married, and just as Hamilton had, actually worked as a lawyer before getting into politics by representing New York. So these blokes were very much in the same sort of political wheel, well, the same kind of life wheelhouse, really, being involved in the Revolutionary War, having an interest in politics, working as a lawyer, you know, in the state of New York. And so very, 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 very interesting to see the broad parallels between the two at the beginning of their story. So Burr worked as a public servant throughout the 1780s. He rose to become the New York State Attorney General and then ended up becoming a senator in 1791. Beating out, actually, interestingly, Hamilton's own father-in-law in the election for this Senate spot. But after the 1796 presidential election, he became loosely aligned with the Democratic Republican Party and turned into quite a political power broker with significant influence in New York politics. And it was here, as I said before, that his rivalry with Hamilton took off. And, you know, I mentioned that Burr had won his seat off of Hamilton's father-in-law. But he'd also engaged in some political chicanery to set up a bank in defiance of Hamilton's Federalist influence monopoly on the New York banking system. Now, Hamilton, of course, a big proponent of centralized banks. And what Burr did basically was sort of do some wheeling and dealing, some legal finessing in order to set up, right, a bank that loaned money to small business owners that were on a very partisan basis, right? So this increased his influence as a Democratic Republican power broker because he loaned money to these people, to these small business owners, in order that they could then meet the property requirements for the vote, right? And of course, now that they had the vote, who are they going to vote for? Of course, the Democratic Republicans, because they're the ones who gave the money. So a very neat little system that that Burr set up there, and obviously it enraged Hamilton and went against what the Federalists were, you know, trying to achieve there, in effectively suppressing an enormous amount of voters, which, you know, isn't a stellar thing to have on your CV there. Anyway, bottom line is Hamilton spitting chips, absolutely spewing ears. He hates this. He bloody hated Burr personally, in addition to their political differences. But when it all came a gutser in 1800, right, the bitterness between these two blokes got taken to a whole new level. Because I said before, during the 1800 presidential election, Hamilton worked to undermine the re-election of Adams, the Federalist president, despite them being from the same party. And this backfired on him. As I said, all his wheeling and dealing did was split the Federalist vote. So ultimately, none of the Federalist candidates ended up getting enough support. And this resulted in a big win for the Democratic Republicans. Now, Jefferson was the leading candidate for them, and he picked Burr as a running mate, no doubt due to his role as a New York power broker. And these two won the election handily with 61.4% of the vote, a huge majority, easy game. However, this was all before the reforms of the 12th Amendment. This is all very complicated. We don't need to go into it too deeply. But basically, back then, before the 12th Amendment changed all, the Electoral College was, believe it or not, even weirder than it is now. Each college member had two votes, but didn't distinguish between voting for president or vice president. So basically, whoever got the most Electoral College votes became the president, and whoever got the second most became vice president. And this is how you ended up with weird situations like Thomas Jefferson being the vice president to John Adams, despite them being on different sides of the political spectrum there. Anyway, the Democratic Republicans, with the lion's share of the Electoral College votes, they had planned to fudge the votes, right? So Jefferson got 73, while Burr only got 72. This was their plan to rort it from the very beginning. Because Jefferson was the leading candidate, he was going to be president and Burr was going to be vice president, but they stuffed it up and both somehow they didn't do the right thing and both got 73 votes instead of, you know, the one bloke who was supposed to turn up and not vote for Burr. So weirdly, the House of Representatives now had to break this tie. That was how it worked, to decide whether it was going to be Jefferson or Burr that would become president. But Burr, Burr knew what the plan was. He knew that he was going to be vice president. He knew he was going to give it over to Jefferson. He knew that this there was this plot to sort of, you know, have the Electoral College votes pan out in a certain way. But rather than go along with his party's plan, remember, he wasn't a huge rusted-on member of the Democratic Republican Party, and he was actually very happy to try to chance his arm and test his luck with the House of Representatives with a vote which might actually put him in the White House. Why go against his party's plan? I mean, why do this to himself? Well, because the House of Representatives was controlled by the Federalists, right? And not only is Burr, you know, not a hugely staunch Democratic Republican like Jefferson was, the Federalists bloody hate Thomas Jefferson. So he thought he'd have a chance of winning the House vote for president, the House controlled by the Federalists, given how much the Federalists hated Jefferson, their principal rival. They think he gambled and he thought, well, they'll see me as the lesser of two evils and they'll go for me instead of their hated rival Jefferson. But guess what happened? Check this out. Alexander Hamilton, he may have disliked Jefferson politically. They did not get on politically speaking, but he absolutely bloody hated Burr. He hated Burr so much that he leaps off the top rope and mobilizes his own Federalist Party to vote in favor of Thomas Jefferson, the Federalist's mortal enemy, just to ensure that Burr doesn't get the gig. So think of this as a situation, right? The chief political rival of the Federalist Party, Thomas Jefferson, is now being campaigned for by Alexander Hamilton, the same guy who campaigned against the last Federalist president. You've really got to wonder what this bloke is up to. Anyway, because of the voting rules and because of the need for a clear majority amongst the 16 states, right, it took 36 ballots before the House actually came to a result. All of the other ballots were actually divided. And Hamilton, he worked tirelessly throughout all these tied ballots, these divided ballots, to convince Federalist congressmen to vote for Jefferson. And slowly but surely, he won enough people over and managed to persuade enough Federalists that it was Jefferson and not Aaron Burr who was the lesser of two evils, and therefore delivered his old rival into the White House. Now, Burr, he's now spitting chips. He is absolutely ropeable. He's buggered it all up beyond belief, because check this out. Of course, he's the vice president, right? No one's taking that away from him. That's done. That's done and dusted. But in not conforming to the original plan of the Democratic Republicans and ceding his position in this ballot to Jefferson, he, of course, absolutely ruined his standing with the new president. By going against what the Democratic Republicans had initially planned, right? Burr had basically burnt any bridge between him and, you know, the president Thomas Jefferson, of whom he is now the vice president, right? Ridiculous. So as a result of all this happening, Jefferson never trusted Burr, never let him near any decisions of any importance, and even further, blackballed him from the Democratic Republican Party as well. So poor old Burr, he's lost it all. He's in political limbo. He's a pariah from his own political party. He's still, of course, the vice president, right? But he's a bloody chocolate kettle at this point, mate. He's not very useful to anyone at all. He's doing basically nothing, right? Didn't have a very good time while vice president, the poor bastard. And again, you can trace where all of this came back to. It was all thanks to Hamilton. He had cemented their bitter mutual hatred by deep-sixing Burr's standing and reputation, amongst the Democratic Republicans with the new president, Thomas Jefferson. Burr was just, his reputation was in ruins. Anyway, by the time 1804 rolls around, so we're gonna skip forward a little bit here, right? 1804 rolls around, the next presidential election is coming up. Jefferson had made it abundantly clear to Burr that he's not going to pick him as a second time for the running mate. No, he's not, like, he doesn't like him, he doesn't want him, he doesn't trust him, he doesn't want Burr as his running mate. Instead, right, so Burr realizes that he's going to be out in his ass. You know, he's not going to be able to, he doesn't have a hope in hell of trying to get anywhere near the presidency, the vice presidency after everything that's gone on, right? So instead, he decides, he refocuses, and he decides that he's going to run for the governor of New York. He's going to return to his roots, he's going to rally, he's going to try a different tack and get his political career back on course a different way. Now, of course, we all know that Jefferson went on to win the 1804 election, this time with George Clinton as his running mate. Clinton became the vice president, and the election was held with the new rules laid out in the 12th Amendment, so it was slightly less bonkers. George Clinton, by the way, no relation to former US President Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was actually born Bill Blythe, but he took his stepfather's last name as a young man. Anyway, Burr, as I say, he decided he'd have a crack at the governorship of New York. But guess who was there once again to stand in his way? Once Hamilton got wind of the fact that Burr was attempting to change tack politically, he once again leapt into action, agitated against Burr, pulling out all the stops, and did everything he could to make sure that Burr's campaign was unsuccessful. Now, you remember, I mean, Burr did have a lot of influence in New York, but so did Hamilton. Hamilton's one of the founding fathers. He's got a lot of political reach. He's as a friend of Washington's, as the first secretary of the Treasury, this bloke has got a fair bit of political weight to chuck around, and he brought this to bear once again in attempting to convince everyone that Burr was not up to the job, right? And this time around in 1804, this took a rather more personal, the campaign was fought on a rather more personal note by Hamilton against Burr this time. And this emerged on the 24th of April, 1804, when a newspaper called the Albany Register published a letter from a bloke named Charles D. Cooper that had been sent to Hamilton's father-in-law, the very same bloke that Burr had beaten in a previous election. And in this letter, right, Cooper wrote about how Hamilton had seen Burr as, this is a quote, a dangerous man and one who ought not be trusted with the reins of government. And it didn't stop there, because Cooper went on to say that he had heard a still more despicable opinion, which General Hamilton has expressed of Mr. Burr. Now, this might not sound like much these days, given that, you know, political discourse has become what it is today. But this was an affront and a grave insult against Burr. And he wasn't going to take it lying down. Burr immediately demanded that Hamilton either properly come forward with this despicable opinion, actually tell everyone what this despicable opinion was, or apologise for the insults and slander of, you know, the last, what, 15 years or so. Now, Hamilton responded, however, by saying that he wasn't going to be held responsible for the way that someone else had interpreted what he'd said, although he also did nothing to deny Cooper's claims about him having given a despicable opinion. And Burr responded to this by saying, "Political opposition can never absolve gentlemen from the necessity of a rigid adherence to the laws of honour and the rules of decorum." In other words, why don't we take this outside, Hamilton, mate? And Hamilton replied by saying that he had no other answer to give than that which has already been given. So this was all done by letter, by the way. It's important to note that, which is why we have a record of it. But it's also why, when the original insult appeared in a newspaper in April, we had to actually wait until July before the actual duel. The long and the short of it was that after all this nonsense, Burr formally challenged Hamilton to a duel, and Hamilton accepted the challenge, and so the duel was on. And we're going to take a quick break from the story here to talk about dueling and its place in history. Of course, you've almost certainly heard of it, and you'll be aware of the tropes around dueling, although not all of them are based in reality. Dueling has been around around forever, you know, as a way for people to, usually men, usually very idiotic, hyper-masculine men, in order to settle their differences or, demand satisfaction from one another in the case of a perceived insult or injury or whatever. And one of the most famous duels from antiquity, a long, long time ago, is the one between the Horatii brothers and the Curatii brothers from the 7th century BCE. So, 2,700 years ago. This duel was fought in a place, it was fought in the place of a full-scale war between Rome and another city, Alba Longa. They were having some difficulties, they were having some arguments, but they were also facing the threat of an external military marching in on them. So they knew that if they actually fought, then this third party would come and just absolutely rumpa-dump them. So they decided to settle their differences with a duel. And so the long story short, the Horatii and for Rome were nominated as the champions, three of them, these triplets, these brothers, and the Curiatii, which I'm almost certainly butchering the pronunciation of, were going to represent, they were going to represent the Albans, right? So the way that it went, the Curiatii, they killed two of the Horatii during the duel, but then the last Horatii, Publius, right, he managed to kill all three of the Curiatii and win the duel. And he then went back to Rome, bloody hero, get around, what a legend, he's won the duel. But, oh no, what's this? His sister, Camilla, had actually been engaged to one of the blokes that he just killed. So she's weeping and having a terrible time and great big carrion, crying and wailing his name. And so Publius responded by pulling out his sword and killing her as well, his own sister, saying that none should mourn the death of Rome's enemies. Pretty bloody brutal, but that's the way that that went. More than a few twists and turns in that one, you reckon? But plenty of other stories and plenty of other duels over the years, of course. And in time, a formalised set of rules was established for dueling known as the Code Duello, which sounds completely fake, to be honest. But this Code Duello, it dealt with things like participants bringing seconds and doctors and witnesses and set out how things should go when a duel takes place. And the main aim of the code, weirdly enough, was to make dueling as safe as possible, like as non-lethal as possible and as fair as possible, while still allowing people to fight or at least put on a big show of bravado or whatever else they're like that. So, you know, doctors coming along and treating anyone who was injured, and plenty of witnesses there so no one could go back away from the duel and said, oh, you know, this is what he did, he bloody, you know, kicked me in the fork, or he did this, or eye gouging, or whatever else, you know. So there were plenty of people to actually watch it, so these, you know, these affairs of honour could be settled. All very silly. I mean, all very, very silly, but that's just how things went back then. Seconds were, so the doctor, we don't understand why the doctor was there, we understand the seconds there to obviously bear witness, but they were also there to try to get the duelists to make up and be friends before the fight. So the duelists would actually attempt to smooth things over between the two aggrieved parties, but failing that, the seconds would set up the dueling area and then stand by and watch so they could go back and tell the story of what had happened. And this was all set out in the code duello. Duels are very rarely to the death, not on purpose anyway. Some people were killed because that's just the way that it goes, but they were rarely to the death. But also, they weren't usually fought to first blood, which is, you know, how things are usually depicted these days in fiction. Usually they were fought until one person couldn't continue, at which point the doctors that, you know, that had been brought along, they'd step in, they'd end the fight. A lot like boxing or martial arts today, the doctors would step in, they'd say, well, this bloke, you know, you batter the crap out of him, he's not going to be able to get back up, so, you know, you're the winner, congratulations. So, again, as I've said, a lot of it was about bravado, honour, more than it was actually about getting hurt. And so when pistols began to replace swords, it became very common to throw away your shot. In other words, deliberately miss, right? So a lot of duels in the 18th century would go like this. Two blokes would turn up, they'd have a turn, shooting off to the side into the ground near-ish their opponent, and that would be that. Now, dueling with firearms, it was codified in the Irish Code Duello, which was adopted in 1777, and this led to the popularity of pairs of identical dueling pistols as a way to make sure things were fair and it was a level playing field, both people using the same firearms. But interestingly, right, throwing away your shot, deloping as it was called, was actually banned by the Irish Code Duello. It was seen as, you know, not the done thing, despite the fact that it was very much the done thing, because often in the heat of the moment, you challenge someone to a duel, you go home, you cool off, you think about it, you go, bloody hell, I really don't want to have to duel with this bloke, I don't want him to kill me. So people would just, you know, shoot into the ground and generally, you know, they'd both go home to tell the tale and talk about how they, oh, you know, should have seen the other bloke, all that sort of nonsense there. But the sort of the path, the trajectory that dueling took as we get into the 19th century and as we approach our story with Burr and Hamilton, is that duels are beginning to become increasingly frowned upon and in many places illegal as well. So for this reason, duelists would skirt through grey areas, as we'll discuss. They'd go to places like islands in the middle of rivers that delineated state borders, like the sandbar fight. And they jump through other ridiculous hoops to avoid getting in trouble with the law. And before we wrap up our chat about the Code Duello and dueling in general, I want to mention as well that, interestingly and quite unsurprisingly, when you think about it, it was the Code Duello that eventually led to the sport of boxing, because the Marquess of Queensbury rules for amateur boxing grew out of the Code Duello. Rules like using gloves, no punches below the belt or to the neck, banning things like grappling and eye gouging, you know, all this sort of stuff. It made the fights much safer. I mean, there's still fights, bloody hell, but it gave you a better chance of walking away in one piece anyway. But this led to the rise of pugilism in the late 19th century and consequently to boxing as the sport that it is today. So, you know, there is quite a bit of history behind all this sort of stuff, but we are going to go back to 1804 now and this duel between Burr and Hamilton that's just been set up. And again, as you can probably guess by now, after having heard about the Code Duello and how duels were sorted out back then, it was a lot more about pomp and circumstance than it was about actually, you know, hurting or killing each other. But having said that, this one was more than a little bloody weird, because Burr was definitely blowing this whole situation up. His pretext for having the duel was a little rickety. It wasn't as insulting to his honour as he was making it out to be, the stuff that Hamilton had or hadn't said. And it was definitely him kind of, you know, making a bit of a mountain out of a molehill there. In fact, it actually made him look kind of bloodthirsty, while Hamilton's acceptance of the challenge made him look kind of suicidal. I don't know. Like, both, the point I'm trying to make here is both of these blokes, right, the bottom line is it just didn't need to happen. Both of them, one of them, either of them, just could have walked away, but neither did because, you know, well, because I'm not sure exactly. There's actually a lot of speculation as to why both these blokes went through with it. It's obviously to do with, you know, honour and prestige and your reputation, that sort of stuff. Burr must have felt that his honour could never recover without a duel, you know, to come back from Hamilton's attacks on his character during the gubernatorial race. And Hamilton, on the other hand, I mean, he accepted the duel without really intending to fight it properly. He fully intended to throw away his shot, but as to why he agreed to it in the first place, it wasn't very clever of him. He wrote about it extensively, actually. He wrote this statement about his decision to duel Burr. He discussed how he was, you know, putting his family's welfare at risk, their financial well-being, how he it went against a lot of his personal and ethical beliefs and values. But I mean, maybe he felt like he had no other choice. Maybe he felt like he was going to be the more ethical person there by turning up and throwing away his shot in contravention of the Irish Code Duello. Look, I mean, I did a lot of reading on that. If there is some sort of historical consensus, I was not able to find it. It does seem a little weird that Hamilton went through with this when he didn't have to do it. I mean, believe it or not, here's the thing that really puts it over the top for me, right? Hamilton's own son, Philip Hamilton, had been killed in a duel in 1801 when he duelled George Ecker after Ecker called him a damned rascal. Now, you'd think that the loss of a son, especially, you know, the loss of a son who ended up in a duel because he'd insulted some other hothead, right? You'd think the loss of a son would have actually put Hamilton off the idea of dueling. But no, as remarkable as it is, it didn't seem to deter him. And it really is a bit baffling as to why Hamilton accepted the duel. I guess if we're talking about honour and we're talking about prestige, there is another factor that does come into it. Hamilton has the very dubious honour of being the first major US political figure to have been involved in a sex scandal. So maybe the loss of honour and prestige from that was hanging over him, and he didn't think he could recover from turning down a duel. In 1791, he had an affair with a married woman, and this was discovered by the public years later, and it prompted a huge scandal. Interestingly as well, the woman's husband found out long before the public did. The husband knew about this affair and actually blackmailed the pants off of Hamilton and even encouraged his wife to continue the affair so he could keep extorting money from this bloke who was sleeping with his wife. Anyway, as I said, Hamilton did actually write this statement, and you can go and read it. It's called Statement on Impending Duel with Aaron Burr. It's not very long. And in it, he explains, well, how truthful he was being in this letter remains, you know, a matter for debate. But he did seek to explain why he accepted the duel. And, you know, he talked about a loss of honor. He talked about the feeling that he needed to do it in order to save his prestige and whatever else. But he also talked about the fact that he was going to throw away his shot, right? He was not going to properly take part in the duel. And he's going to do this, in his words, to give Burr a chance to pause and reflect. So I don't know if the whole thing was just to try to teach Burr a bit of a lesson. There is a fair bit of debate as to how sort of genuine and earnest Hamilton was being in the statement that he wrote. But look, the long and the short of it is he accepted the duel and it was on, and there was no getting out of it now. So with the duel organized, both men made preparations to travel out to Weehawken in New Jersey, a very deliberately chosen spot. I mentioned before that dueling was on its way out, legally speaking, and by this stage it had been banned in both New York and New Jersey. But this spot, Weehawken, it was a popular dueling location, as New Jersey was much more lax in enforcing anti-dueling laws than New York was. And even more remarkably, it was actually the very same place that Hamilton's son had his fatal duel a couple of years ago. So on the morning of the 11th of July, 1804, Hamilton and his associates, they were rowed out to the very place that his son had been fatally shot to engage in the same activity that had killed young Philip. And Burr also made his way there with his respective crew. And I think at this point it's probably worth pointing out some of the ridiculous things. I mentioned before some of the ridiculous things they did to skirt around anti-dueling laws. In order to offer plausible deniability to the people there, the pistols were hidden in bags, or hidden away in traveling bags, so the rowers could truthfully say that as they rowed them out, they never saw any weapons. And additionally, it had been decided that everyone there, seconds, doctors, everyone, right, would turn their backs and not witness the duel firsthand, again, so they could truthfully deny ever having seen either man shoot at each other. It all seems like a great big song and dance to, you know, to go through when the whole thing is about gentlemanly honour, but whatever, that is how it went. Anyway, both parties, they arrived at the arranged spot at 6:30 in the morning, and after the seconds had marked out the dueling area and determined where both duelists would stand, Burr and Hamilton, they took up their positions. Everyone else turned their backs, utterly ridiculous, and these two political rivals, bitter enmity coursing through them, began their fated duel. Now, what you'd expect to happen, ordinarily, you know, according to the customs of the time, was for the two men to stare at each other, and then in a very silly and pointless display of overblown masculinity, point the pistols off to the side and fire into the ground. And that's it. That's a duel finished, and, you know, they can walk away from it with both of their heads held high. I mean, totally, totally silly. So ridiculous, the whole thing. I don't know how it got to a point that shooting into the ground near-ish someone counts as having your demand for satisfaction fulfilled, but whatever, right? But, of course, that's not what happened, as many of you listening will already know. Now, because there were no direct eyewitnesses, there is no clear factual account of everything that took place, but here are some things, right? Here's a small list of things that everyone agrees on, at least. There were two shots, although we don't know who shot first. Hamilton's shot went over Burr's head, striking a tree branch. Burr's shot, however, hit Hamilton in the lower abdomen, and this caused Hamilton to collapse immediately. Now, if Hamilton shot first, it's thought that if he shot first and didn't fire into the ground as Burr might have expected him to, then Burr may have assumed that Hamilton was actually attempting to shoot him after all. After all, he didn't know that, as we do now, that Hamilton had written of his intentions to throw his shot. So under the code Duello, Burr was now entirely justified in trying to hit Hamilton as well, you know, and trying to kill him, because it seems to him that Hamilton is just trying to take a shot at him and just missed terribly. But conversely, if Burr shot first and indeed was trying to kill Hamilton from the beginning, Hamilton may have just shot wildly as a reflex while collapsing and had his bullet hit the tree instead. Again, Hamilton wrote about his intention to throw the shot away, which was, again, let's remind ourselves, prohibited by the code Duello, as dishonorable as it may have been to do such a thing. That's what Hamilton said he wanted to do. So Hamilton may have just shot above Burr's head, deliberately missing, which may have misled Burr and then caused him to actually take aim at Hamilton properly. Or Hamilton could have shot first, and as I say, Hamilton may have just shot his shot as a reflex or as part of just collapsing to the ground after having being hit. It's worth pointing out too that it's entirely plausible that Burr really actually may have tried to kill Hamilton, given how much they hated each other. While it may have been customary for the two people to delope in a situation like this, it is actually entirely, it's plausible, it could even potentially be probable, that Burr did seek to kill Hamilton here. Years after the duel, Burr spoke more than once about his intention to kill Hamilton during the duel, indicating that he may have, gone to this duel with murderous intentions. But the plot thickens here. And this is why I've made a bit of a song and dance about the fact that Hamilton may not have been entirely honest with us when talking or writing about this duel. Because there's been the suggestion that Hamilton was actually trying to martyr himself to Burr. Before they took up positions properly, Hamilton made a great big fuss of adjusting his glasses, testing the sights on his pistol, and doing all sorts of little other things that could have been a deliberate provocation. Why? Because Hamilton knew that if Burr shot him, he would also end his own political career. He'd be absolutely ruined as a politician afterwards. So maybe Hamilton was actually trying to rile Burr up and get him pissed off enough to actually try to shoot to kill, just to ruin Burr's career as a politician. Unbelievable. And as it turned out, of course, bit of a bloody Pyrrhic victory there, Hamilton, old mate. But, you do you, I suppose. Now, regardless of whom shot first, and irrespective of, what the intentions were going into the duel, Hamilton was shot, he collapsed, and as soon as he did so, Burr's squad quickly grabbed Burr and whisked him away, ushered him away to the boats, as Hamilton's seconds and his doctor rushed to his side. Now, the doctor, a bloke named David Hozak, actually happened to be the very same doctor who had tended to Philip Hamilton's wounds a few years ago, and unfortunately, this situation was just as grim. Hamilton was terribly wounded. He was paralyzed, and despite his companions rushing him back onto the rowboat and back to New York, he never recovered. The bullet bounced off his false ribs, tore through his insides, and lodged itself in his vertebrae. And this meant that after 30 excruciating hours, Alexander Hamilton, surrounded his bedside by his wife, their remaining children, many other friends and family, he finally died on the afternoon of the 12th of July, 1804. Again, just over a day, 30 hours after he'd been shot by Aaron Burr. As for Burr, he fled to South Carolina for a time. But don't forget, this guy was still, he's still the vice president. Like, he's still the vice president of the United States. You shot a man dead, but he's still vice president, even if Jefferson was giving him the old freeze out. He was charged with murder in both New Jersey and New York, but ultimately never stood trial. He very cunningly avoided standing trial. He very, very, very cleverly avoided this happening with the ingenious method of staying away from those two states, and then the charges were eventually dropped. But the reason for the New Jersey charges being dropped, actually, it's particularly hilarious. New Jersey decided not to prosecute Burr for the death of Hamilton because, although he shot him in New Jersey, Hamilton died in New York. So the perfect crime. I didn't know that's how it worked. The next time you want to murder someone, just invite them to the Four Corners Monument from Breaking Bad. No worries at all. Anyway, eventually Burr did return to Washington, and despite never standing trial for murder, he himself was present at the impeachment trial of a Supreme Court judge and oversaw this trial with a great deal of even-handed political neutrality, which set a very important precedent for this sort of thing, I might add as well. That is perhaps the second most historically significant part of Aaron Burr's legacy, perhaps. Anyway, once Burr's term as vice president was over, he travelled west and had a number of adventures out there that led to President Jefferson, of course, instituting the Insurrection Act in order to bring him in. We heard about that in episode 103. The long and the short of it was that war was potentially brewing with Spain, and Burr apparently gathered troops and made ready to seize land for himself in the event of an armed conflict. But this war never came. But that didn't stop Jefferson from ordering the capture of Burr. And once Burr had been brought back to Washington, he was put on trial for treason, although never convicted. Jefferson threw the kitchen sink at his former vice president trying to get him done. And it was actually a very important test of the separation of powers in the United States, as because Jefferson leant very heavily on the judge to convict Burr, but this ultimately had no effect and Burr was able to walk free. However, he had no hope, absolutely no hope whatsoever of any kind of political comeback after this. Killing Hamilton, being charged with treason and, you know, importantly, owing a lot of people a lot of money, this all meant that he fled Europe, therefore, with some money that he borrowed from none other than Dr. David Hossack, the same doctor who had seen to both Hamiltons. Ridiculous. This bloke just keeps popping up in this story. Anyway, Burr travelled around Europe for years between 1808 and 1812, but eventually returned to the United States under a new name, Aaron Edwards. And he went back to New York, continued working as a lawyer. But after having a stroke in 1834, he also finally died 2 years later in 1836. Now, both Burr and Hamilton, of course, earned their place in history for many reasons. Hamilton, of course, the more famous of the two, is remembered for his role as the first Secretary of the Treasury under Washington, his writing the Federalist Papers, and as one source put it, his role as the visionary architect of the modern liberal capitalist economy. Burr, on the other hand, set a firm precedent for even-handed impartiality as the vice president's role as the president of the Senate, which went on to influence many other vice presidents across the centuries. However, on top of all of this, it really is the duel between these two that resonates the strongest throughout history when we talk about either Aaron Burr or Alexander Hamilton. And of course, this duel has served as the centerpiece in many pieces of popular media over the years, including the wildly successful musical Hamilton. Finally, one last consequence of the duel between these two was, of course, the way that it bolstered the growing anti-dueling movement. Hamilton's death aided, these people who were campaigning against dueling, people who used his death as an example of why an end should be put to dueling altogether. And of course, as we know today, dueling has slowly but surely died out in the years since then. And obviously there were other factors that went into it as well, but the death of a high-profile statesman like Alexander Hamilton certainly catalyzed that change. But none of this stopped descendants of both Burr and Hamilton meeting in Weehawken in 2004 on the 200th anniversary of the duel, and they met there in order to reenact it. Thankfully, however, no one died this time around. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of Alexander Hamilton's duel with Aaron Burr. Very interesting to learn some of the sort of behind-the-scenes details that went into quite an iconic piece of American history there. So I do hope you enjoyed the story. All the normal boring housekeeping stuff coming your way here, halfasthistory.net. Contact form there if you want to get in touch with the show. Old episodes, links to subscribe, of course. If you want to leave an iTunes review, I'd appreciate that. If you want to buy some Half-Ass History swag, halfasthistory.bigcartel.com, free shipping worldwide, and stocks starting to run a little low. So if you've been thinking about it, now's a great time to get ahead of the, get ahead of the rush. It's probably not going to be a rush, but look, if you want a t-shirt, I just don't want you to be disappointed, mate. Just if you want a t-shirt, just go and buy a t-shirt. You can also support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/halfasthistory. Thank you very much to the new Patreon members who have subscribed. Got a couple of people who have started chucking me money that way, and I tell you what, I bloody appreciate it. So thank you very much to those. If you'd like to join their exalted ranks, of course you can gain access to uncut episodes, show notes, and you get the episodes a little bit ahead of time as well, ahead of the common muck as well, so you can enjoy that. But thank you for listening to the show, of course. If you want to tell your friends and family about it, I'd certainly appreciate that. Get the word of Half-Ass History out there. Got to get those numbers up, rookie numbers in this racket. But as I say, that is that for this week. We're going to close things out as usual with a question posed on Reddit. Reddit historian Hugh Jamerican asks, would the musical Hamilton be more accessible to younger audiences if he were played by Lynn Automatic Miranda?